selected a great topic and a great speaker.
A great topic, don't
The American elections are all very much on our mind as we listen to the play out, particularly for the leadership of the Democrats every morning on AM, and we see them in the news. And it is a very different system to the one that we're used to in Australia. And every time it happens, every couple of years, I have to think, what's the difference between the primaries and the secondaries? And we probably all go through that. So we thought, given that the final results will happen in the US elections later this year, and there are a lot of hot political issues that are part of the national debate in the US as part of the pre-election process, it would be very timely for us to have a world expert speaker on American politics. John Hart is precisely that. While he's based in the Australian National University, he is known around the world for his expertise in American politics. We were at the US Information Service earlier this week and talking to the cultural affairs attaché, who was saying he believes many American political theorists think you're American because they read your work and they have no idea that you live in Australia because of the level of expertise that you have. John is a great presenter as well and will offer us some very interesting insights. He's presented before at the Parliamentary Library, but only to staff. He thought this was such an important issue and such good timing that we would make it a proper Parliamentary Library lecture. And he has published widely on politics, American politics and other politics. The Parliamentary Library was very fortunate in 1997 to publish his monograph on the British general election in 1997, and I think the latest book he's been associated with is Breach of Trust, How Washington Turns Outsiders into Outsiders, which is Tom Coburn with John's contribution. Is that not your latest?
It's a different John Hart.
It's a different John. Here was I doing all of this research this morning. Isn't that interesting? But we're very fortunate to have such an expert, and I'm sure he'll offer us some great insights into the election and American politics. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks, Roxanne. I really love having my CV inflated. let me apologise for my lateness. For those of you who haven't been outside, there is parking chaos around here. I don't know why. I'm really surprised that the Parliament doesn't have a dedicated parking spot for visiting Parliamentary Library lecturers. Anyway, thank you for your introduction. Thank you for inviting me to speak at this Parliamentary Library lecture. Let me deal with the retrospect part of the title of this lecture first. The one thing that can be said with a degree of certainty is that, in retrospect, the big loser in the presidential election so far has been expectations. Since the presidential race got underway at the tail end of 2006, almost all the expectations that the pundits have had about this contest have at one time or another been proved wrong. My guess is that if you did an analysis of whatever every major talking head in the American media has said about this election, from the beginning of January 2007, you'll find that none has got it consistently right, and most of them have done more flip-flops in their predictions and prognostications than the candidates themselves have done over their policy positions. The one thing that the election tells us about the American electoral system is that it's so dynamic, in a very real sense of the term, that the course of events is subject to so many variables that it makes any kind of prediction nothing more than a hunch or a guess, or dare I say, an expression of one's ultimate belief in who should win. But it goes beyond prediction. The dynamism impacts on expectations, and that's how, and that affects how we read and we understand the election while it's going on. So let me just say a brief word about the role of expectations in presidential elections. I think expectations is a major understudied field. In the lead up to an American presidential election, there is an immense amount of discussion long before any electoral action, and almost all that discussion focuses on expectations about what will happen in the future. Those expectations come to us through the media, and through the talking heads who dominate the media's coverage of election campaigning. Those expectations can really make or break the campaign of many candidates. If you don't do as well as expected, your candidacy can be doomed. And if you do better than expected, you become the darling of the media, irrespective of whether you actually won a primary or not. We don't know much about how those expectations originate. We don't know why some of those expectations spread so quickly and become conventional wisdom. We're certainly not told anything about the scientific foundations of those expectations. But we do know that they emerge in the context of a highly competitive ratings battle on election night, where ultra-slick production, extravagant but almost meaningless computer-generated graphics, and the quest from the ultimate one-liner from the pundits are now the order of the day. I watched election night coverage on Super Tuesday while I was in Washington that week, but my interest quickly turned to horror. Fox was unwatchable, CNN turned out to be a freak show, ABC and CBS were in competition to see how many commercial breaks they could fit into each pundit's one-liner. I eventually stopped channel surfing and settled on PBS, the public broadcasting service, which has no money, no computer graphics, no viewers, at least to the extent that PBS is not involved in the ratings war, and a very plain studio with just David Brooks and Mark Shields along with Jim Lehrer. None of them seem to be aware that election night analysis now has to be high entertainment. They salvaged Super Tuesday for me, but generally I think it's bad. But admittedly, there's a need on the part of the American media to make a viewer-unfriendly nomination process understandable to the average viewer or reader. But I do think it's led to a level of oversimplification, and that oversimplification affects what we are told to think about the progress of the presidential nomination process. They do this by focusing largely on the horse race aspect of the presidential nomination process. The American media is obsessed with identifying the winners and losers long before the race has actually started. They are focused on the strategies of the runners and riders. In any single primary contest, they want to be able to call the winner of the race after just the first furlong. All this is supposed to make it understandable to the average viewer, but it seems to me that there is actually a big difference between a horse race and the American presidential nomination contest. By and large, horse races don't have that many rules. The jockey gets on the horse and basically rides the horse as fast as he can to get to the winning post. I know there are some rules about fair play, but generally speaking, the horse race depends on the speed of the horse and the skill of the jockey and not much else. That's definitely not the case with the American presidential nomination contest. It may be a race of sorts, but it has rules, it has lots of them, and the rules are amazingly complex. They are not media friendly by any stretch of the imagination. How do the media cope with this? Well, I think they tend to avoid questions about rules and processes and only broach this kind of thing when they absolutely have to. Take, for example, the current interest in the role of the superdelegates in the Democratic Party convention. Superdelegates have actually been part of the Democratic Party's nomination process since 1984. They were created in a specific context for a specific reason, and they're meant to perform a specific role. It's not quite true to say that they've never impacted on the nomination process before. They have. But the outcome of the nomination process has never depended on the superdelegates. But if you listen to some of the garbage that's being written about the superdelegates now, you'd think they were only invented 3 weeks ago and are nothing more than undemocratic and an illegitimate group of party hacks who really shouldn't be in a position where they might have to select the next Democratic presidential candidate. And that is not the case. In the American presidential nomination contest, rules and procedures play a big part in the outcome, and to some extent they help shape the outcome, and sometimes I think even account for it. Just to give you a crude example, If the Democratic nomination contest had been conducted under Republican Party rules for selecting their presidential candidate, then Hillary Clinton would have had the Democratic nomination sewn up by now. Under the Republican rules, her primary victories in big states like California and New York and New Jersey, Ohio, Texas, Massachusetts would have given her more than the 2,000 plus delegates that she needs to secure the nomination. And if the Republican contest had been played out under the Democratic rules, then John McCain would definitely not have been the ordained Republican winner by now. Mike Huckabee would be giving McCain a lot of problems. I think Mitt Romney would still be in the race. And it's not even certain that right now, under the Democratic rules, McCain would even be ahead. So in short, I think the rules and the procedures matter, and they matter in an assessment about the expectations of the candidates. And I think that's ultimately where the American media fails. They give insufficient attention to the way the nomination race is conditioned by more than just the speed of the horse and the skill of the jockey. They underplay the rules and the processes, and that's one reason why I think the predictions and the prognostications and the expectations have left so much to be desired this year. So let me focus on the nomination race through the lens of the rules and the processes and give you my take on some of the important things that have been happening. Some of the things that may have contributed to why expectations have turned out to be so far wide of the mark. That's not to say that political explanations don't explain the nomination race. Clearly they do. Something is happening in the United States. Certainly there's a phenomena around Barack Obama, I think it's important. I'm going to kind of steer clear of that kind of thing and focus on something that I think a lot of the media rarely focuses on. The first feature of the nomination race that needs some comment is the heavy front-loading of the primary and caucus schedule. For the last four elections, states have been scheduling their primaries or caucuses earlier and earlier in the election year. This year it resulted in some 24 states having primaries or caucuses on the first acceptable date, February the 5th, in what became known as Super Tuesday. The reason for this is simple. States didn't want to have their primaries or caucus after the candidate had been effectively chosen by voters voting in other states where the primary had been scheduled early in the calendar. Front-loading has been increasing in each of the last four presidential elections. This year, more than 50% of the total number of delegates in each party were selected or on their way to being selected by February the 5th. So no wonder states want to front-load, want to go earlier for fear of being left out and totally irrelevant in the process of selecting candidates. Now, for political scientists who specialise in presidential primaries, the front-loading of the calendar has become the number one problem of the presidential nomination process. The general view is that front-loading shortens the effective primary season. It gives a huge advantage to the front-runner. It lessens the opportunity for voter deliberation. It puts a higher premium than ever on money. And it advantages the candidate who has already got the resources to fight a large number of contests in one go. It effectively creates a national primary, which many consider to be undesirable, and so it reduces even further the quality of campaigning. So for political scientists, front-loading is generally considered a bad thing. And on top of all these defects, this year's front-loading created an additional very serious problem when the states of Florida and Michigan decided to get into, I suppose, what you might call super front-loading and hold their primaries in January outside the window laid down by the Democratic and Republican Party rules. And I'll say more about that in a minute. For political parties, however, the front-loading was supposed to be a plus. If all the things I just mentioned were true, front-loading would ensure that intra-party divisions over the presidential nomination is minimised, it's got over with quickly, and the parties can avoid a long, drawn-out and bitter contest by settling the whole issue very early on in the race. Well, I'm not saying that political scientists and the party politicians got the theory of front-loading all wrong this year, but I do think a number of talking heads in the media did subscribe to the conventional wisdom, and that was one of the reasons why expectations were so far out. What I would venture to say about the effects of front loading was that it worked differently this year. It clearly hasn't shortened the primary season, at least not on the Democratic side. It hasn't given the front runner, Hillary Clinton, an advantage that she was supposed to have got from front loading. In fact, it seems to have caught her campaign unprepared for many of the contests that came after Super Tuesday. I also don't think front loading has reduced the amount of voter deliberation, if only because the front loading got this year's presidential nomination race off to a very early start, earlier than ever, and the number of nomination debates probably reached saturation level in 2007. And surprisingly, opinion polls showed an unusually high level of voter interest in the nomination race during pretty much the whole of 2007. Expectations were confounded by the fact that the front loading of the calendar played out differently this year to previous years. But I think, generally speaking, the other problem was that the attention given to front loading actually deflected concern from other more arcane aspects of the presidential nomination process that had just as important a bearing, just as important a bearing on the outcome. Here I'm thinking of the rules relating to delegate selection, the rules regarding who can participate in primaries. But before I get on to that, let me just say one more thing about the front-loading contest. This year, front-loading has got out of control. Too many states had primaries on one day, and that impacted on the attention the candidates gave to some states, including the really big ones like California. California moved its primary date up in the calendar for the third presidential election in a row. It did so because it wanted to attract interest from the candidates that it thought a big state ought to attract. But the move seemed to backfire. California didn't get that much attention, nor did most of the Super Tuesday states individually. Iowa and New Hampshire got far more attention and time from the candidates than did California. I think Iowa and New Hampshire got more attention than California and New York and New Jersey and Illinois combined. So the front loading didn't do, at least for those big states, what it was intended to do. In fact, with hindsight, California would have been better off if it hadn't joined the front loading scramble and stayed behind at the back of the pack, where it might have got the kind of attention that the state of Pennsylvania is going to get between now and April the 22nd, when it has its primary. Both parties have got to do something about the primary schedule before the 2012 election. They have to tackle the front-loading problem because it does have adverse effects on the nomination contest sometimes, and I think because its effect in any given year with any given set of candidates is unpredictable. Political scientists will need to think again about the effects of front-loading. It hasn't worked this year as many of them thought it would. And political parties will have to review the monster that they've created, because this year, at least, front-loading hasn't done the job that the Democratic Party thought it would do for them. There are a number of proposals for restructuring the primary schedule, but there is no consensus between the parties. And American politics is still a long way from sorting out this mess. And while the parties are trying to sort out the front-loading mess, they might also address the related but separate problem of the privileged position of the states of Iowa and New Hampshire in the nomination calendar. These two quite untypical small, white, rural states command a disproportionate amount of time and resources from the candidates and the media. They still have a major effect on the winnowing of the field of candidates, and there is simply no rationale for Iowa and New Hampshire being in this exalted position. It distorts the nomination process, and I think weakens the quality of the nomination contest. In fact, the stupidity of it all was demonstrated when both Iowa and New Hampshire maintained their God-given right to be the first caucus state and the first primary state, and they were even threatening to move their caucuses and primaries into December 2007. In the end, Iowa fixed its caucus for January the 3rd and New Hampshire went on January the 8th. And a lot of people think that was just far too early. And it was the privileged position of Iowa and New Hampshire that caused the big shambles of this year in the nomination contest, the decision of Michigan and Florida to break the party rules, hold their primaries in January. For that, I think the Democratic National Committee Chairman, Howard Dean, invoked a penalty that he must have known he couldn't enforce to turn around to two important, electorally important states like Florida and Michigan and say, we won't seat your delegates at the convention, must surely rate as the dumbest thing Howard Dean has ever done. And even if the Democratic contest hadn't been as close as it's turned out to be, I can't see any way that the convention would ultimately have sustained the unseating of two such important state delegations. But Michigan and Florida also miscalculated badly. They gambled on making such an impact on the campaign that it was worth the threat of being denied delegates at the convention. The thinking behind Michigan, I think, had some justification. Michigan argued that the crucial early stages of the nomination contest in January, when Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina and Nevada held their primaries or caucuses, precluded the input of any large industrial, racially mixed, competitive state. And Michigan believed that the large states, the urban states, ought to have a voice in the critical winnowing period when many candidates are forced to drop out. But Michigan's expectations were all wrong. It misread the front-loading effect, basically assuming that the presidential nomination from both parties would be wrapped up very early on before the convention, that the convention would merely rubber stamp the primary vote, and just as in previous years, the winner would be well known before the convention. So Michigan gambled on having a big impact on the primaries by going early, in exchange for being seated at what they saw as a meaningless party convention that nobody took any interest in these days. But Michigan didn't anticipate the boycott on the campaign by the candidates. No one went to Michigan or Florida, so their early primaries had absolutely no impact on the course of the contest. But 500,000 voters voted in the Michigan Democratic primary, 1.7 million voted in the Florida primary. Presumably they voted in good faith, and it's absurd that their views should be excluded from the convention because of the heavy-handedness of the Democratic National Committee and the political miscalculations of the state Democratic Party leaders. So, let me just say this. There is no consensus on how to deal with the front-loading problem. There is no indication that either party is prepared to face up to the Iowa and New Hampshire problem. In fact, the Democrats spent the year in 2005 reviewing the timing of the nomination process, and they simply caved into Iowa and New Hampshire and let them continue to have their caucus and their primary outside the pre-window, during the pre-window period. The Democrats' response to the front-loading problem was to recommend that the Democratic National Committee and the state parties agree on a schedule of no more than five contests in any one week, a recommendation that all the state Democratic parties promptly ignored for this year. And there is no sign that the Democratic Party has yet found an acceptable solution to the way in which Michigan and Florida will inevitably be seated at the convention. It's all a very sad state of affairs. Although I've spent some time in front-loading, I do think other aspects of the process and the rules played their part in confounding expectations. And without getting into a long and probably boring explanation of the technicalities of the nomination process, let me say just this. I have a hunch that when the serious analyses of the nomination race are done by serious students of the process, they might well show that at least part of the explanation as to why expectations were so far out has to do with the impact of arcane and very complex rules. Certainly, for example, the Democratic Party allocates its delegates at the convention roughly proportionally, both pundits and certainly Hillary Clinton's campaign team underestimated the degree that that would affect her chances of getting the nomination if by any chance the candidate got locked into a close race, which is precisely what's happened. by and large, the fair reflection rule in the Democratic Party, which assigns delegates proportionally, hasn't been much of a problem in the last 25 years, and for the first time it proved to be a major problem in 2008, and is clearly a major reason why the Democrats haven't been able to close out the nomination contest so far. Secondly, I suspect that when all the data is available, the party rules regarding whether a primary is open to participation to non-registered supporters, party supporters, or whether it's closed to registered party supporters will be another explanatory factor. It seems to me that in the Democratic Party, the large number of open primaries early on in the schedule, these are primaries in which non-Democrats are allowed to vote, would have aided Barack Obama and handicapped Hillary Clinton. The initial signs are that Obama has done very well with independent voters voting in the Democratic primaries, whereas Clinton's support seems to be coming from the party regulars. In the Republican Party, I think it's likely that the data will show that McCain drew more support from independents voting in the few open primaries that the Republican Party had than any other candidate. However, I'm not saying that was responsible for McCain's victory. I think by far the biggest reason for McCain's victory was that the bulk of Republican primaries are winner-take-all primaries, and McCain did very well in most of these. In California, for example, he won 91% of the delegates out of the California primary with just 42% of the vote. In the same state, Mitt Romney actually won 35% of the vote, and he managed to pick up, although it was a winner-take-all primary, he managed to pick up just 9% of the delegates. So he got 7% less of the vote than McCain, but almost 80% less of the delegates because of the winner-take-all system. Incidentally, if you want some idea of just how complex the rules of the nominating game are, the Republican Party actually operates 10 different types of delegate selection system across the 50 states. They have caucuses. They have winner-take-all primaries. They have proportional primaries. They have two states where the type of primary depends on whether the winner gets a majority of the vote. If the winner gets a majority, it's a winner-take-all. If they don't, it's proportional. They have loophole primaries. They have combined winner-take-all primaries and caucuses in the same states. They have advisory primaries. There's one state where the Republican Party combines winner-take-all at district level with a proportional allocation at statewide level. And there's one Republican state, one state Republican Party that runs a combination of a winner-take-all primary at congressional district level, a proportional primary at statewide level, and a caucus at statewide level. And the 10th one I can't describe because I just can't understand it myself. There's a kind of a sophisticated madness going on here. Getting back to the impact of the open and closed primaries, I do think one consequence of the 2008 contest is that the Democratic Party needs to look very carefully at its generosity in allowing non-Democrats to participate in who the Democratic candidate is going to be. There are too many open primaries on the Democrat side, and one consequence of that this year, if the choice of candidate is going to rest with the superdelegates at the convention, as it may well happen, the superdelegates are going to have to decide whether their vote at the convention is going to represent in part the wishes of non-Democrats who seem to have invaded the Democratic nomination contest this year in what could be fairly significant numbers. Let me turn briefly to the question of money in the nomination contest, because that's been interesting this year. And in this respect, things didn't go according to expectations. Two things have been different this year, and one of them has affected the expectations about Hillary Clinton. First, Bill Clinton started a pattern in 1996 when he ran for his party's renomination of raising so much money so early on in the election cycle that he scared off potential challengers by simply monopolizing the pool of money available to Democrats. Admittedly, he was the incumbent president at the time, but remember 1996, things weren't going too well for Bill Clinton. And it's my view that his campaign finance strategy did work and helped scare off a potential challenger or two. George Bush did exactly the same thing in 2000 when he ran for the Republican nomination. He got the nomination in large part because of the early fundraising, the massive amount of early fundraising, and the lack of funding available to other Republican candidates. The expectation this year was that Hillary Clinton, the Democratic frontrunner for the whole of 2007, would follow the same strategy and monopolise the pool of funds available to Democratic candidates. But it didn't turn out that way. By the end of 2007, both Clinton and Obama had raised over $100 million each, and Clinton was only ahead of Obama by just $3 million. The latest figures I have seen show that Obama is now just ahead of Clinton in the money-raising stakes. He's raised a total of $140 million so far, and Clinton has raised $138 million. This is the most expensive Democratic nomination race ever. I think there's a big question about how Obama did it that's interesting. The outsider who was way behind Hillary Clinton in the polls, in national polls in 2007, managed to match her dollar for dollar, and subsequently overtake her. And I think the big story of the 2008 presidential election will be Obama's superb fundraising ability. In part, the answer lies in his exemplary use of the internet, not only for raising funds, but also for organising his campaign and mobilising supporters to get out and vote. And I think there will be books in that alone. But I still think the money is interesting. The FEC, the Federal Election Commission records, show that all the money has come from from individual donations. Obama denies that he's taking campaign contributions from PACs. If that's the case, then he's shown incredible skill in raising money. I won't say any more about this, except that I'm a little bit sceptical. Anyway, the point I wanted to make is that Obama's fundraising ability wasn't expected. It certainly helped neutralize Hillary Clinton's the advantage she was supposed to have. The second significant development this year is that between them, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have killed off public funding arrangements for presidential nomination contests in the US. Because they refused matching public funding for their campaigns, they also were free of any spending limits. What they were saying was that the amount of money available to candidates through the public funding scheme is no longer sufficient, and the availability of much larger amounts of money from private sources destroys any incentive to work within the spending limits. The same will be true for the election proper. Both have indicated that they won't take public funding for the election proper, although cash-strapped John McCain is trying to make an issue out of this. The major consequence, I think, is that Clinton and Obama have created a situation now where candidates who do accept public funding are perceived to be weak. And that was the case with John Edwards. The moment he said, "I'm going to take public funding for his nomination race," that was the beginning of the end, I think. And while Clinton and Obama's decision over public funding is perfectly rational and understandable, I do think it's the final nail in the coffin for public funding in the United States, and I happen to think that's a great pity. Well, I've said a lot about the election in retrospect. Let me say something about prospect. And given that expectations have turned out to be so wrong thus far, I'm loath to tie anything I'm going to say about to any future expectations that might turn out to be totally wrong at all, as well. Firstly, the Democrats still have to conclude their selection process, and there is simply no way of anticipating the outcome. There's going to be a four-week wait until the next important primary in Pennsylvania on May the 22nd. If Hillary Clinton wins that, the race will go on to the Indiana and North Carolina primaries on May the 6th. If she loses it, it's possible that political pressure, irrespective of the delegates that they've got, political pressure might mount for her to get out of the race. A lot of Democrats think that this election's been too divisive already. The role of the superdelegates in the Democratic Convention could play an important part. And I think it's important to stress that the origin of the superdelegates at the convention lay in a reaction to the impact of the McGovern-Fraser reforms, where party officials, party elected leaders were virtually excluded totally from the party convention and excluded totally from the most important choice that a political party ever makes, who its leader's going to be. The superdelegates were created after 1980, they came into being in 1984, and they were put there to represent the party's interest in the selection of the party candidate. And I can't see the logic of Barack Obama's line that the superdelegates should be democratic and just vote the way their state voted. I mean, if you get to the convention and the nomination race is deadlocked between Clinton and Obama and neither have got a majority of delegates, then the superdelegates simply, you know, acting democratically, are going to perpetuate that deadlock. It's quite conceivable that the superdelegates will be faced with the most difficult decision they make, how to resolve a very unusual deadlock at a party convention without appearing to be undemocratic. I don't know how it's going to turn out. The problem of Florida and Michigan also has to be resolved. I feel pretty sure in saying that ultimately delegates from Florida and Michigan will be seated. But who those delegates are, how they split between the candidates, what arrangements, under what arrangements they're seated at the convention, who knows? There's absolutely no consensus on how that's going to turn out. Hillary Clinton wants the original delegates selected to represent the way the primaries turned out in those two states. Barack Obama doesn't. Barack Obama's come up with this idea that the two state delegations should be split 50-50. Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? So that's another aspect of the nomination process that you just can't anticipate how it's going to turn out. I think the consequences of a divisive nomination contest must include the possibility that the divisiveness will impact on the actual election campaign, and at worst, Democrats who supported the losing candidate will be so alienated that they'll be reluctant to turn out to vote for the Democratic candidate in November. But it's not always the case in the United States that a divisive nomination contest does do this kind of permanent damage to the campaign. I suppose, you know, one possibility is that the divisiveness gets so bad that by the time the choice of presidential candidate is made, the only option for that presidential candidate is to choose the other as their running mate. That would, you know, everybody's saying that's the dream ticket. I think to two people it would be the nightmare ticket, you know, Clinton and Barack Obama. They hate each other. But, you know, that may be one possibility. The interesting prospect this year is that the Democratic Party convention might just matter again. Party conventions have fallen into disuse over the last 25 years or so because the choice has in effect been made by primary voters long, long before the convention met. This year, the Democratic convention might actually get some airtime on American television. What about the election itself? Well, look, I think predictions about the outcome are just an exercise in futility at this stage. Certainly, political science doesn't have the tools to predict the outcome of the election now, even though it's desperately trying to develop forecasting models that will be able to do so. There are simply too many uncertainties. We don't even know who the Democratic candidate will be. And, you know, there's even an element of uncertainty crept in over John McCain. The New York Times ran a story just 2 weeks ago that he didn't meet the presidential qualification clause because he wasn't a natural-born citizen of the United States. McCain was actually born in the Panama Canal Zone. I don't think anything will come of that. But, you know, you never know. I mean, why did the New York Times bother to print it? Insofar as the election is concerned, a bit of politics, it seems to me that it's going to be more difficult for McCain than it is for the Democratic candidate. because McCain will be running against the Democratic candidate and against his own party's incumbent president. And in a way, I think McCain will still have to use the election campaign to persuade the right wing of his own party that he's acceptable to them. And the problem with the Republicans this year is going to be turnout. There's disillusion on the part of some Republicans with McCain because he's not perceived to be conservative enough. But if he uses the election campaign to shore up the right of his party, it's going to be very difficult for him to move to the centre to mop up, you know, the middle, independent, undecided voters. It should be a Democratic year. A Washington Post ABC poll published last week showed that if the election were held now, and of course it's not going to be held now, it's going to be held on November the 4th, but if the election were going to be held now, both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama would beat McCain quite comfortably, at least in the popular vote. Obama is 52% to 40% against McCain. Hillary Clinton is 50% to 44% against McCain. It also showed that more Americans, 40%, think of themselves as Democrats than Republicans, 29%. That's a good sign for the Democrats. The primaries themselves have actually showed a much higher level of turnout for Democrats than Republicans. Just looking at the figures from the primaries last week in Ohio and Texas. In Ohio, just over 2 million people voted in the Democrat primary. In Texas, nearly 3 million people voted in the Democrat primary, compared to under a million in the Republican primary in Ohio and just 67,000 in the Republican primary in Texas. So Democrats have been turning out in much, much higher numbers, and those figures are true pretty much everywhere in the state. So that's a good sign for the Democrats. And of course, all the opinion polls, and this isn't new to you, show very high levels of public dissatisfaction with President Bush. His disapproval rating in the Washington Post last week was 66%, and that should help the Democrats too. The polls are also showing a high level of interest in the campaign and a potentially high level of voter turnout that would favour the Democrats. Who's going to win? Look, I really don't know, but I read it. There's your answer.
Well, that was just so insightful and just very helpful for all of us. And John is very happy to take some questions.
Scott.
I'm not sure I should ask this, John.
Well, then don't.
What on earth is a loophole primary?
A loophole primary is a very technical primary where the vote for the presidential candidate and the vote for delegates are separated. And it operates at district level. And it allows the primary, it allows delegates to be selected from the state that have no relationship whatsoever to the way the beauty contest went. The Democrats have banned blue poll primaries, but the Republicans still operate them in a couple of states.
Well, I've got a question too. One of the things that we see reported is the number of young people who are voting for Barack Obama, and with the open state voting for some of the Democrats, voting many young, probably a great percentage of young people in a ever done so before. Do you think this is a re-engagement of Americans in the political process?
Yeah, as I said, something's happening, and I'm not quite sure what it is. I mean, I think there is a phenomenon with Obama. He is mobilising young voters. But then so did Howard Dean in 2004. At least we were told that. I mean, not to this great extent, but it didn't materialise when they were young voters have one of the lowest turnout rates of any age cohort in the United States. So, but I mean, something is happening this year, and I'm hesitant to say anything about it because I think it's, you know, it's so complex and so mysterious that you can't get a grip on it yet. I mean, there is Obama mania in the United States. He's clearly inspiring people. I'm not sure why, because I don't see it myself, but it's happening, and it's very, very difficult to. Yeah, I mean, trying to analyse what may be a big shift in American politics while it's happening is not easy.
Mm. I wondered, in terms of explaining why there's such a, an uptick of interest in the presidential elections, is that I wonder if one of the possibilities is the fact that for the first time in well over 50 years, neither party is putting forward a president or vice president as their presidential candidate. I wonder if that, the fact that it's so wide open, there's no establishment candidate in that sense.
Except that it seems from some of Hillary Clinton's rhetoric that she actually thinks she's been vice president. I think you're right. You know, it was an open contest. I thought the problem with that, I'm one of these people that got expectations wrong this time last year. I thought the open contest in the Republican Party would actually cause problems. Because what it was looking like, the way it was shaping up around September, October, was that you were having a very close race between four or five candidates. Each you were sharing about 15 to 20% of the vote nationally. And I thought the outcome could well be quite random. You know, McCain would win some primaries, Romney would win some, Huckabee would win some, and it would just be a total mess and it would go on and on and on. As it happens, that hasn't been the case, and I still can't provide a good explanation for why McCain has managed to come back from the dead in the way that he has. And of course, the problem has affected the Democrat Party. It's going on and on and on. But I do think, nowhere apparent, no obvious candidate way ahead has prolonged the contest and generated a lot more interest. And, I think it's also important that there is a Democratic, a woman candidate running this year and a black candidate running this year. Makes a difference.
So, Swanji, do you have to be registered with some party or any such organisation to actually vote in November? Do you have to have voted in the Bronx?
It depends on which state you live in. You don't have to be a formal party member. The general pattern is that in most states, when you go to register to vote, if you want to vote in those states' primaries, you indicate that when you, in the party primaries, you indicate that when you go to register to vote. So that on primary voting day, you'll be marked on the register as Republican or Democrat, and you'll be allowed to vote in those primaries. But you don't have to be a party member in any formal sense. And that's, what some people think has been the problem with the American nomination process, that the people who are really making the decision about who the presidential candidate is going to be have a very, very loose attachment to the party. And that's why there was the effort to get some party regulars back into the process through these superdelegates. I didn't mention when I talked about superdelegates, we hear about them, but you don't actually know who they are. Well, you might be interested to know that one of the superdelegates is Hillary Clinton. And another is Barack Obama. And another is Bill Clinton. So she's got a 2-to-1 lead to start with.
Got another couple of questions. Did someone have your hand up there? No?
My question is more, I agree. I'm from the States, so I see that a lot of Democrats are completely confident, regardless of Obama or Clinton, whoever it is, they believe that Democrats will win outright. And I mean, a lot of Republicans are even getting into this. But don't you think that because the final nominee for the presidential nominee for the Democrats won't be decided until so late, don't you think that this really hurts the Democratic platform? Because they're going to be so divided as a party, while McCain has all this time to figure out how he's going to get the conservatives and then the centrists to really agree on policy. I feel like it's actually going to hurt the Democrats.
Well, look, that's one way of looking at it. What I would say is that I don't think there's a terrific amount of division between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on policy issues. The division is over personality and things like capacity for leadership. I mean, the trouble with a nomination contest is you're never going to get a really good policy debate because it's a contest between people in the same party who generally think the same. A lot of people do think it's very divisive. The other side of the coin is this is precisely what the primary system is meant to do. It's meant to test candidates over a period of time in different parts of the United States. And I somehow think that both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton might be better for the experience that they're having in this long drawn out nomination contest when it comes to running against John McCain, simply because the primaries have done what they were meant to do. It's a testing ground. It's enabled Obama to deal with issues that maybe if he's the candidate and they come up in the campaign, could really damage him. So I think there are two sides to it. And my interest as a professional political scientist is to let it run as long as it can. I mean, it's great stuff.
We might just take two more questions.
There is a likelihood that Ralph Nader may join the race. Can you factor in that?
You know he's older than John McCain. I think Nader had a terrible, terrible impact on the Democrats in 2000. I do believe that Nader is the best explanation for why Gore lost. I mean, in the state of Florida, the difference between Gore and Bush was 537 votes, and Nader won 96,000 votes in Florida, and all the polls and the surveys are showing that about two-thirds of Nader's votes came from Democrats. But I think a lot of other people have realised that Ralph Nader is now not the popular guy that he was in 2000 or before that. I think he's on an ego trip. There's no reason why he should run. His message this year would be the same as it was in 2004 and 2000 and before that, and it's not making much impact. It's not having much resonance with the electorate. All I can say, he'll be a spoiler, but the effect of his spoiling will be a lot less than it's ever been before.
I'm interested in the relationship between the turnout at primaries and the turnout in November. One of the counter-arguments for the effect of the long primary battle between the Democratic candidates is that they're training their voters to turn out, which is obviously a significant impact in US elections we don't have here, in November, because they're having these massive interest, massive turnouts in Texas and coming up in Pennsylvania. I'm wondering if there's information on what the relationship is between the turnout at the primary and then the turnout in November, and in particular the turnout for independent voters voting in open primaries, and whether if you get a big turnout of independent voters voting for the Democratic primary, whether those independents are then more likely to A, turn out, and B, vote Democrat in November.
The relationship between turnout in the primaries and the elections, the turnout in the election itself is much higher. What I think is important this year is that the turnout this year in the primaries compared to previous years, at least in the Democratic primary, is significantly higher, and it's sending a message that maybe there's a lot of interest in this campaign and a lot more people will vote. The problem with independents is you can't actually tell except through exit polling survey data the number of independents, the impact that independents were having on primaries, but you can't even begin to guess at their numbers. The other thing is that there's something of a bit of a myth of the independent voter in America. A lot of independent voters are actually disaffected Democrats or disaffected Republicans, but they still lean towards the party of where they came from. And generally, when you go into an election, those who decide to vote the way they're leaning. There aren't that, I reckon probably the true independent in America probably amounts to 10%, not the 28% of the electorate that the polls are showing now. I think they will matter. But you can't say too much about them because the outcome, it depends how many independents are actually voting in Ohio or Florida or whatever the key states are, and there will be key states in 2008, I'm almost sure. You can't quite tell which ones they are now, but they'll have an impact, but you can't say too much about the impact.
Well, it's been very fortunate to have your time today and have your thoughts. It's been tremendous to get the perspective on those key issues and for everyone to be able to ask some
questions.
Thanks
very much.
Thank you.